Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. They were lawmen, they were lawyers, they were pickpockets, and they helped build this town from the bottom up. I'm talking about the Irish in Kansas City, and today we'll talk about the Irish dominating the police department in its early years. In fact, of the first 16 policemen killed in the line of duty here, 12 were Irish or Irish American. We'll also talk about Irish lawyers and bulldog Frank Walsh and violence on Southwest Boulevard between the Irish and the American Protective Association. Our guide today is Kansas City's own Pat O'Neill. He's the author of From the Bottom Up, The Story of the Irish in Kansas City. His father created the local St. Paddy's Day Parade, and Pat is the principal over at O'Neill Marketing and Event Management. And Pat, so good to have you.
Good morning, Steve. Welcome it's really back. Great to be here.
Well, quite a history, the Irish in Kansas City. Talk about colorful, right?
It's colorful because we have a little bit of everything to offer here. I mean, from scoundrels to heroes, but both ways they had a huge influence on the way our city is today.
You know, we're going back into the late 1800s today, and I'm wondering how tough was it for you to track down some of this history, Pat, because you're digging back pretty far here.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. I started off with, just thumbing through all the old microfilm and going to newspaper accounts and the Star and the Journal Post. And we forget there were a lot of little newspapers. There was, the Catholic Register, and there was the World, there was an Irish newspaper. And so they were great sources of information. And, trusting that those reporters were accurate than I am or am not. But a lot to be found in there, summing through around St. Patrick's Day. And then St. Patrick's Day was always right before the city primaries as well. Yeah. So you go back into that, you get a mix of the politics and the celebrations.
You know, newspapers looked a little different back in those days, didn't they?
But they went into great detail.
They sure did. And I always think of the Irish in this town, I always think of the word pride. A whole lot of pride.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting is with the parade coming up, the original parades back in the 1870s were really just that, Steve, because, the immigrants at that point in time were still marginalized, and they were still, people were suspect, and they were mostly relegated to menial jobs, and most of them were working in railroad construction or street work or public works and those kinds of things, and in the fire department, just getting into the police department at that point in time. So it was pride in numbers, That was, yeah. I think, one of the Irish, Patrick Ford, I think, was one of the big nationalist editors in Boston, I think, at the time, and he said that was the one day the Irishman could be a man. He could stand up to his full length. And so, we're all like that. Once we it's not the mob rules, but when you get together with a crowd, you feel stronger and bigger. And that's exactly what those early parades did.
We're talking about lawmen, lawyers, and outlaws when it comes to the Irish here today, Pat. Let's turn to the late 1800s and talk about lawmen a little bit. How dominant were the Irish when it came to Kansas City's police force back in those days? Because I didn't realize some of this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're a microcosm. Kansas City's a microcosm of New York and Boston and Philadelphia and those cities. And at the same time, the Civil War came on. There were, the immigrants from all over the world were, pouring into New York and the East Coast. And actually, even in New York, they discovered that, their own police force was not up to the task, especially dealing with the immigrants. And so the Irish, especially after the Civil War, many of them had gained their first ever any sort of military experience, becoming even close up with a gun, in the Civil War. And so when they came out of the Civil War, when they mustered out from Confederacy or Union, they were on both sides, then they made good policemen because they spoke English, they had some military training, they were tough, and they could deal with especially the Irish immigrants, which took up huge chunks of the minority and poor populations and on the coast. Hmm. They could deal with them emotionally and language, both emotionally and literally.
And so they really dominated the force then.
They did, and here it was no different. By 1867 or so, there was a fellow named Dennis Dennis Malloy.
Dennis Malloy,
who had been a decorated veteran of the Civil War. He helped start the force, and we started with 25 policemen. So naturally, if he was one of the founders of the police force, he rallied his friends and recruited. And at one time, in those days, it grew to probably 200, 300, and 400 police officers. And you could look at the rosters, and up to 3/4 of them were Irish or Irish born.
And Dennis Malloy actually helped found the police department.
He did. And interesting, he was from County Clare. And his wife, this interesting little tidbit, his wife, Sarah, was the lady who prepared the barbecue and the opening of the Hannibal Bridge feed the town at the celebration.
One of the great moments in this city's history, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
right around that same time.
Maybe the most important moment in this city's history.
But right around the same time, he helped found the police force. And then after that, you take it all the way through to you have a series of Irish police chiefs all the way up to Clarence Kelly. The police force went through was a pretty proud organization. It was tough and street savvy, and when we got into the Pendergast era and the bootlegging and all the organized crime, then of course
it dipped a little bit.
It dipped, and it was primarily controlled by the Joe Shannon forces, which were the rabbits, we call them. They were the Pendergast goats and the Shannon rabbits, and he was conceded control of the police department, which control meant, for the most part, not necessarily orchestrating criminal activity, but taking advantage of the patronage, the number of jobs there. Because that was, most immigrants come to this country and they start off with the shovel and pick, just like the Irish did. And one of the first steps up is, the police department, fire department, and jobs of respectability. So it went through a dip in those days and then came back. Clarence Kelly was our police chief for about 12 years and before he went to become director of the FBI in 1973.
Tell us about Clarence Kelly, because when I first came to town and covered police in the mid-80s, Clarence Kelly, sort of the specter of Clarence Kelly, loomed so large over the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. He'd been chief and, of course, as you just said, FBI director under Richard Nixon. He was quite a person.
He was, and he had a lot of respect and a lot of credibility, and especially, Kansas City, we're always proud to be on the map, and when he became, the director of the FBI, only the second director, I guess, that was a big deal, and it gave a credibility to the police department that had been maligned for quite some time, as you know, being under state control. And so, I think, and then you even after him, the most recent Chief Corbin, so it's a stereotype, but it's a proud one the police department is.
I was going to say, going back to the 1800s, then, and this line of Irish police chiefs, these were highly respected guys in this town. How highly respected were they, Pat?
Well, I always get a kick out of the old. We go back to the St. Pat's parades, and that's when the Irish honor their own, and. The police chief was traditionally the grand marshal, and that required a saber and a plumed hat and riding a horse. And as one old Irishman policeman said, if you've never ridden atop a steed with the wind blowing and trying to hold onto your hat, and then you've know nothing of it, there was Chief Jeremiah O'Dowd was a fixture at the head of the parade for years, and then followed by subsequent police chiefs. But those early parades, it's fun to note that, they were big affairs. They were much like they were today, only they were very ecumenical. And you'd be surprised to know that you go back. This parade often started in the River Market, in the city old city market, and it would work its way up to St. Patrick's Church on 8th and Cherry, and then it would there'd be mass, be concelebrated by 3 or 4 priests, and then the parade would emanate back out the door of the church, and it would wander all over downtown, all the way down into the West Bottoms, and go by the old St. Teresa's
wherever the leader chose
High
to lead
school,
it sounds
and,
like.
And the Bishop Hogan would read poems in Gaelic at one stop, then they'd end up in the West Bottoms by Annunciation, which Annunciation Parish was in the West Bottoms, was the largest parish, Catholic parish in the state. It had something like 1,500 families down there.
Because people forget how many families used to live down there
before the railroads just expanded and expanded and expanded, and the packing houses expanded, and people moved out, and they got better jobs, and they moved up. It's hence the name of my book was From the Bottom Up.
I bet marching in one of those parades would have been an absolute blast, right?
It would have, but you might be right behind the Temperance Society. There were several of those, and the German clubs, and they were and the police.
Why were the Temperance Society allowed to be in a parade like that? time.
Well, you know, in those days, it was a religious celebration. It was a celebration of pride. It wasn't the debauchery and party that we've come to kind of know and sometimes expect.
Well, then I take my previous comment back. Maybe it wasn't as much fun as I thought it would have been.
the fun part was at the end two things. Well, there's an old Irish policeman that was interviewed back in like 1920s when he was retiring, and he just pined for the old days. He goes, he'd pined for those days when we drowned our shamrock. Drowning the shamrock consisted of, at the end of the parade, you'd be walking down the street, and everybody had shamrocks, dried shamrocks, that were sent from their relatives in Ireland. And this is in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And the custom was to pin it to your lapel, and then after the parade, I'd see Steve walking down the street, and I'd go, Steve, have you drowned your shamrock yet? And he'd go, no, I haven't had a chance yet. So you'd pop into the pub, you'd drop it in a beer, and you'd shake it back off, drink the beer, and pin it back to your lapel and proceed down the street until your next friend said, Steve, have you drowned your shamrock yet? And you'd say, no, as a matter of fact, Pat, I haven't had a chance yet. And you'd pop in and do it again. And then there'd be dances at Long's Hall and different places like that that would go late into the evening. And so there was it had its fun, but it also had its serious note. By first, it is the feast of Saint Patrick, the patron saint of Ireland, and that was that and Mass were the first at the top of the list.
We're visiting with Pat O'Neill this morning about the Irish in Kansas City. His book, From the Bottom Up: The Story of the Irish in Kansas City. Well, what do you know about some of the early Irish police officers who were killed in the line of duty, Pat? I mentioned that of the first 16 officers killed in the line of duty in Kansas City history, 12 were Irish or Irish-American.
Yeah, I mean, I'm estimating it based on the names, and they're not all completely documented, but yeah, it's pretty close. And they were street cops, and they were, they patrolled the roughest neighborhoods, and most of them were killed thwarting holdups or domestic violence. I thought one was interesting. The police officer killed in 1903 was because he drowned trying to rescue people in the flood of 1903, which was a devastating flood down in the north end.
Yeah.
I mean, in the West Bottoms. And so it was all kinds of maladies that took a lot of lives. It was a rough profession back in those days, you know?
Yeah. You also mentioned that by the 20s and 30s, the reputation of the department had begun to turn due to the Pendergast machine. What happened there, and what kinds of a factor was all of this, in all of this, was organized labor?
Well, and those are two kind of separate questions. Mm-hmm. But the labor, I take that part out for now, but the in the 20s and 30s, and we always talk about the Pendergast machine, but there were, the car had numerous parts, not just the engine. And again, Joe Shannon, who was the East Side Rabbit boss, Democratic boss, was generally controlled the police department. But then again, when you get into those days of especially into the 30s, policemen didn't make much money. And it was all about cash, and it was all about, there was, of course, the clubs and the late nights and all the infractions, all the vices that were going on. So, it became corrupted like it probably did in most everywhere else around the country, and with under the table money and, an easy 10, 20 bucks Pat picked up, Pat the street cop picked up, as he was strolling blindly down, 12th and Vine at, at 4 o'clock in the morning and ignoring whatever he saw.
Yeah.
So there was that. And then, of course, we had some serious issues with vote fraud and issues at the polls, which, I can almost, and I don't want to jump over your question, but go back to the 1890s when we talked a little bit about the American Protective Association,
we'll get to that here in a little bit.
But there was clashes on election day for years. In fact, my own grandfather or great-grandfather was called a proven scoundrel because he tended to have thugs at the polls on, when he was running for the city council.
Mm-hmm.
And he won by handily, I might add.
Again, Pat O'Neill's our guest. We're talking about the Irish in Kansas City. We asked for your Irish family stories about members on both sides of the law, and Courtney's tweet demonstrates that some associations still continue today. She tweets this: my cousin in Jersey is half Irish, and he just got out of jail for getting caught working for the mob. True story, she writes. So I'm wondering, Pat, that's in Jersey. Is there anything like an Irish mob still in Kansas City today?
No.
No.
No, there's not. And, in fact,
Thank
I even
goodness.
Tried to explore that angle. You know, we didn't have our Oney Maddens and or Legs Diamonds or any of those kind of folks that were the famous gangsters, particularly back east in Philly and New York and whatnot. We had, you know, there were Irish that collaborated with the later what we know as the mob, of course, because most of those, you know, you think about the old dividing lines in the city, and the first ward took up the north end, and in fact, my great grandfather John P. O'Neill was alderman from that ward. And he ended up marrying, his wife had died, and he married an Italian gal. And there was a lot of compromises going on as the shift in power, you know, political and the vices and whatnot. That was a transition that occurred. I always say, you know, the Irish thug, you know, might thump you with a pair of brass knuckles and they sweet talk you later. He wasn't likely to shoot you.
Pat O'Neill again is our guest. 816-235-2888 for your questions about the Irish in Kansas City. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org, or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's turn to some of the lawyers involved in Irish lore going back so many years here, Pat. If you turn to the legal side, and when you think of Irish lawyers in Kansas City, a lot of folks, even today, think about the Bulldog, Frank Walsh. Quite a figure, quite a personage in Kansas City. Who was he?
And a lot of people didn't know about him, but you know, he went head-to-head with James A. Reed, who was the other very prominent trial attorney in the city.
Who became a U.S. Senator,
I think. But in some ways, Frank Walsh eclipsed that in his own way. It's interesting because I grew up with the Walsh family and never really understood about this fellow. But and as we know, you know, the Irish mother's dream always consists of one son who's a priest, one son who's a lawyer, one son's a doctor. You know, and so number two on the list is typically lawyers, and we've probably produced more lawyers than priests, but hundreds and hundreds of them. But Frank Walsh was an interesting figure, born in St. Louis, and in the early part of the 20th century, really his mother was a widow when he was young, and he dropped out of school, like in grade school, to help support the family. So he kind of had a real affinity for the working poor. And he some of his first successes in law were representing iron coal miners and working the garment workers and even the streetcar conductresses during World War One,
right in
after
female.
World War One, they were challenged and laid off because you know they were doing that during the war when the men were all off at World War One, and so when they came back they wanted to keep their jobs and he represented them and he won he was later named by Woodrow Wilson to the Industrial Relations Commission where he investigated and pursued the Ludlow Massacre, where, you know, women and children.
What was that?
It was a mining, mining strike in which the railroad thugs came in and to disperse, you know, the strike, and women and kids were beaten and severely, some killed in the incident. And his work really later came into the National War Labor Board, where he took on people like J.P. Morgan and to ensure that
John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie,
and to help working conditions and conditions for the workers in these very dangerous occupations, and help. He's responsible for at least more safety measures being taken and more humanitarian steps. He was always considered a top-notch humanitarian. At one point, he said it was in the New York. I think the New York Times ran a headline something like "Walsh says, 'Damn the law.'" You know, it's what's more important is safety and humanity. And because there was always technicalities that the railroads or the big industrialists could rely on for not forced labor, but certainly inhumane conditions and work hours.
Well, why was he called the Bulldog? Bulldog Frank Walsh.
Tenacity. Just simple tenacity,
that.
Yeah. And, of course, the Irish loved him, you know, because he was a big, advocate of a free Ireland. And It was very good friends with Eamon de Valera, who was became president of the Free State once it was established, and after the uprisings in 1916, and then the Free State was established in 1922. Frank Walsh was his lawyer, and Sinn Féin's lawyer, and mm-hmm. represented Sinn Féin as well at the Versailles Peace Conference. So he was very active in the evolution of the Irish Free State and was very popular among leaders there. And even Eamon de Valera and other Irish leaders came to Kansas City to visit him, stayed at his house, which is out near Hickman Mills.
So he must have been one of the most preeminent men in Kansas City.
And I remember there was an old lawyer who passed away a few years ago, and he said, as a young man practicing downtown, he would sneak out of his office under the guise of meetings to go watch James A. Reed and Frank Walsh go at it in federal court.
Wow.
He said it was a spectacle. And he goes, it was magical. And he goes, the two lions going at it in court. He said, I learned so much from the two of them. They were both excellent lawyers.
Well, when you would hang out with the Walsh family as a young kid growing up, did they talk about Bulldog Frank Walsh?
Yeah, sure.
Very much?
Because Guppy Walsh, a friend of ours, he was an attorney as well, and it was his grandfather. And sure, I mean, it was a legacy in their family and a damn good one.
Yeah, okay. Where did his drive to protect the working man come from in his life? Just that rough upbringing you mentioned before?
Yeah, I think when you drop out of school at 10 years old, I believe it was.
You get a sense of what that's all about.
Yeah, and you're talking probably late, 1800s when that occurred. And those were tough times. We were in depressions then, or at least a recession as boyhood. And so, you hear these stories. I had to go out and sell newspapers or pick up chunks of coal. Well, kids did. That's what they did back then. I one of the craziest stories I've ever heard. This doesn't have anything to do with anything here, except that I had read a memoirs of an old fireman from KCK, and he talked about the days when people would use their small children in the packing plants down by the river and the offal chutes that went into the river.
The what chutes?
The offal chutes with all the leftovers of the carcasses.
Yeah.
The only thing that edible that went out those chutes typically was the liver.
I can see where we're going here.
Yeah. And the offal chutes were these long, slimy chutes into the river, right? And the catfish grew to, the size of Volkswagen. But he talked about how some of these poorest people would tie ropes around their 5-year-olds, lower them over the wooden sidings down into that offal chute and to pick off the livers. I mean, that's how tough things got back in the day.
That's a heck of a story.
You can picture it, but if you're hungry,
wow,
there's food going in the river down there.
You're going to take it up.
I can't eat liver to this day.
I never have, yeah.
Yeah, I've neither.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Pat O'Neill about the Irish in Kansas City. Pat's the author of a book, From the Bottom Up, The Story of the Irish in Kansas City, and we'll talk about Irish outlaws. We'll talk about
American Protective Association.
American Protective Association and the fights that went on down in the Boulevard. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting this segment anyway with Pat O'Neill about the Irish in Kansas City. He's the author of From the Bottom Up, The Story of the Irish in Kansas City. He'll be speaking at 2 o'clock on Sunday at the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch, downtown at 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. To RSVP, 816-701-3407. I'll put that number out again in just a little while. 2 o'clock on Sunday to hear Pat O'Neill talk about the Irish in Kansas City. Well, Pat, your own father, your own dad helped create the Irish parade in Kansas City, the local Irish parade. Mm-hmm. What did he do?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on which one of his stories you're going to believe. Dad was a great character, and he was a promoter, and he had the strange occupation. Well, not strange because I do the same thing, but of public relations and advertising. But he loved entertainment, and so he would promote you know, all the shows at Municipal Auditorium and in Starlight Theater, and he also ran political campaigns and some of the issue campaigns for Bartle Hall and for, you know, Charlie Wheeler's initial campaigns,
right,
and Joe Teasdale's campaigns, those kinds of things. But his favorite haunt was Dan Hogarty's Saloon, which was at 12th and Baltimore. One of his friends said that's where they went to work out every day because they worked out on the parallel bars. There was Gigi's and there were Hogarty's. but there are some great characters that hung out in Dan Hogarty's place. Dan was the quintessential Falstaffian saloon keeper and a real popular guy, and a lot of characters hung out there, and there were, you know, a lot of lawyers and politicians and you know, off-duty vice squad officers and fences, you know, selling stuff out of the back of their car. It was just a great, great little joint. But he and, you know, Mike Murphy was one of his great pals when Mike was in his heyday back in the day on radio, and they used to, you know, do great thinking there, and at one point in 1973, I think it was, that Dad said they were all sitting around and going, "God, this town is dead as a clam on St. Patrick's Day. It's like, it's embarrassing. You know, we're going to do something about it. We're going to have a parade next year. We're going to have a parade." And so Murphy, of course, you know, wah-wah, jawboned about that for a week or so and then forgot about it, basically, I think, until the next year when people said, "What time's the parade?"
Ah.
And so they, he said, my mother painted the sign on the way down to Hogarty's on St. Patrick's Day, I guess, as the story goes. And she it looked like she painted it in the car. It was a big, big sandwich board that just said parade, and then another sandwich board on the other side said end of parade, and they were going to hang it on Danny Hogarty because he was that big and figured, well, if nobody shows up, he's a parade all in himself.
Yeah.
And so he said they lined up in front of the Continental Hotel, and they were going to walk a block and a fifth. Of course, they said they measured it off, which I'm sure they didn't, so that it would end up in a fifth, and said by, you know, 11 o'clock or whatever the stated time was, hardly no one had showed up, so they were all starting to slink off back towards, you know, into their cars or the bars, and then people started showing up.
Yeah.
And anywhere from, you know, depending on which story you listen to, it was either 30 people or 300 that showed up, and two one-legged dog or three-legged dogs. I don't know how you can find two of those in the same town, but supposedly they were in the parade. Anyway, they walked the block and a fifth, let everybody down to Hogarty's and in the front door, and Hogarty had a banner day. That was the start of a parade.
Well, speaking of parades, when is the parade this year?
It is Sunday, March 17th, starts at 11 o'clock at 33rd and Broadway, right in front of Redemptorist Church, which is very appropriate. It's where my great-grandparents and others lived in the old Cary Patch.
And it's farther south now for a starting point than the old River Market because why?
Well, blocking all the streets in downtown is an arduous
tricky
and expensive task. Mm-hmm. And so Broadway's a wider street out south, and it's not inappropriate because, again, where Penn Valley Community College is now was once called Cary Patch, and that whole area was a lot of Irish-born. Because the Irish, you know, tended
houses
to,
there,
like
you're
others,
talking about, yeah,
you know, they grew, these neighborhoods would grow because, you know, I'm here, I'll save up my money, send money for my sister to come, my mother, my, you know, whatever it might be. And there was a lot of that went on all the way through, really through the 40s and 50s, into the 50s and maybe even early 60s. There was a lot of family still bringing family over from the old country because there's a resurgence, you know, after World War II of people coming from Ireland and then again in the 60s.
Pat O'Neill is our guest. Our number here, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. Ed from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning. Well, as you guys were talking, it made me think tomorrow evening we're going to have our share of cops and lawyers and maybe even a couple of outlaws at the KCK Top of the Morning Club dinner, which is an annual Irish-American club gathering.
And that's going to be where again, Ed?
It's in KCK at the St. Mary St. Anthony Church.
All right.
And all the stories will be 100% true, right?
They will be 100% true, and I will even extend an invitation to you guys to come as my personal guest.
Thank you, sir.
Well, that sounds great, Ed. Thank you for the invitation, and good luck with your event, okay?
Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, let's turn now to the outlaws and the pickpockets that Ed just referred to. There were a good number that fit that category among the Irish of Kansas City, and there's a reason for that, as you point out, Pat, which is what?
Well, and we're talking about you know, that's that era from 1870s through the Depression, probably, in the 30s.
Folks still arriving here. Yeah.
Folks were still arriving. They still hadn't really broken out of the manual labor. There were still rock quarries being operated by the Irish over on the west side. A lot of railroads workers, but they were starting to arrive. But nonetheless, you know, like any other immigrant group, when you come here, you're mostly faced with the bottom rung jobs, and it's no different than the person trying to struggle on $10 an hour at a fast food restaurant, you know. Mm-hmm. And you had a lot of people during those the 90s and 1890s and beyond that had no there weren't any jobs to be had. And my favorite one was, which you have mentioned, was the pickpocket, because there was during the Democratic National Convention that was here in 1900, and you know, everyone knows the story in Kansas City. It's the Great Spirit of KC, when the convention hall burned, 30 or 40 days, 60 days before the convention was to kick off, and they rebuilt it in record time, and everybody pitched in, all the politicians and enemies came together and got it done. And the businesses, you know, were able to thrive and around the convention hall, but none thrived more than Nosy O'Brien's business.
Nosy O'Brien, what a great name.
Nosy O'Brien was an infamous pickpocket in Kansas City. and while I say, while Tom Pendergast and some of the young and fledgling Democrat leaders were inside the hall making connections with, you know, Bathhouse John Coughlin and Hinky Dink Kenna from Chicago, he was outside pilfering wallets and having a banner a week.
Nosy O'Brien.
Nosy O'Brien.
How well known was he around town?
Well, the police all knew him, so he didn't. I think he got busted like the second day.
Yeah, you know,
they hauled him off, but because they knew him by sight.
Let's get back to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Jim from Bonner Springs, you're on with Pat O'Neill. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying the show. I wanted to comment that approximately 30-some years ago, I was watching the news, and there was a news reporter out on the street immediately after the parade interviewing people, saying, "Well, how'd you like the parade?" And they got these blank looks on their face, going, "Parade? Was there a parade?" and you could just see their eyes just kind of rolling, like, what am I supposed to say? And I thought it was just, I tell you what, I've been laughing at that for probably 30 years now, and I'm just so thrilled to get it on the radio.
Thanks for the call, Thanks. Jim. I appreciate it.
Well,
Jim.
The folks at the St. Patrick's Day Parade Committee have done a tremendous job. I think moving it to Broadway and South was a great idea. It's less congestion. It's less it's just less chaotic, and it's much more family friendly. And the last number of parades have been just outstanding. They've been fun, rain or shine. They've been fun, and lots of strollers and people, kids.
Who's the master of ceremonies or the MC this year?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Didn't Mike Mahoney from Channel 9 do it one year?
Mike does. Kathy Quinn did it for years, and it's whichever Blarney talker is handy at the moment, I imagine.
Well, like almost any immigrant group, the Irish had their detractors back in those days. At the heart of that resentment was a group known as the American Protective Association. Pat, where did the APA come from? What was that all about?
Yeah, you know, in our history books, we've read about the Whigs and the Know-Nothings, you know, back in the middle of the 1800s. Well, I kind of almost an offshoot of that, created in the 1880s, was a group called the American Protective Association, and it gestated out of Clinton, Iowa, strangely enough, and it was because when the railroads, many of the railroad workers building the cross-country railroads and all the extensions thereof, were Irish born. And so whenever the work would stop, like whenever the job would stop, the railroad was completed or a link was completed, a lot of times those laborers would settle down right there in that spot and start raising families. And in Clinton, Iowa, that happened. And, of course, the Irish laborers were all kind of congregated and building little shacks on the other side of the tracks, if you will. But the Irish do have an affinity. Like I said, they may not carry a weapon, but they can, but their tongue can do wonders, you know, because they can, and they talk themselves into positions on the city council, and they of course we also are known for our ability to proliferate, and so the population in Clinton, Iowa, grew pretty quickly, and the Irish are in danger of taking over the town on the city council and some of the other and the police department and whatnot. So the nativists, and this was not a new sentiment. I mean, we'd had a lot of this had come and gone and percolated for many years, but they formed this secret sort of society to put up candidates to block the Irish from taking over local and state government. And that sentiment and that organization proliferated with chapters all over the country. And in Kansas City, they bragged several thousand members and a million at one time they claimed to have nationwide. Anyway, that came to a head in the late 1890s when Big Jim Pendergast was coming online and we were really starting to make inroads at City Hall. And in those days, again, you make inroads at City Hall, you're not out to steal the taxpayers' money. They were out to get jobs. They were out to, you know, to break down some barriers to get people into jobs of some responsibility and some income. That was the big deal. But at any rate, we still had our election system that might have been a little maybe not as formal as it is today. And in Kansas City, there was a lot of accusations of not so much – you weren't voting ghosts in those days, but they were hanging around the polls, and if they knew you to be an R, you know, a Republican, chances are they might have diverted your travels, from the poll. And anyway, an APA watchdog was beaten up by a couple brothers, the Pryor brothers, down in the West Bottoms in 1894, just before the election on April 3rd, the city elections. And so as recrimination, some APAers were deputized and sent down to arrest these two guys. And they clashed right down there by the pole.
Create the scene. It's a great story. Create the scene of what happened there. These guys sort of coming down the street, and everyone knew they were coming, and everything else. It's quite a story.
Yeah, it really is. It's I pulled some of this from the newspapers, but as the constable and his entourage, you know, arrived down there at the west side of the Beltline Bridge. Now the Beltline Bridge is still there. It's just in a different format. You know, when you go down Southwest Boulevard and you go past the old Fire Station Number 9, you go under. That was the Beltline Bridge. It used to go over, the road went over it, and the railroad went under it in those days. But anyway, as a constable and his entourage rolled into the west side, just west of Summit, a sidewalk inspector, now, of course, an ward healer named Mike Callahan and a gang of his supporters stepped in front of the first wagon of the constables. And Callahan claimed that the constable had no authority to arrest the Pryor boys. And then, of course, words were exchanged, and then bullets were exchanged. And young deputies, several young poll workers were wounded. Callahan was shot dead and dragged into the Fire Station Number 9, which is still there.
Right.
It's now, I think, legal aid is in that building. But
and people lined up to view the dead body.
The Star reported as the gong of the police patrol wagon rattling down the street, loaded with policemen, was heard. The streets were black with people, Kansas City police officers, Scanlon, Joyce, Kennelly, Doherty, and McDonald came running from their assigned polling places nearby. But that effectively killed the St. Patrick's Day parade. That and some other instances of prejudice and clashes verbally, religious and otherwise. The parade was considered then a spark point for the different factions, and so you didn't see a parade again for almost 80 years.
Well, going back to this murder then, the death of Callahan, how many Irish were convicted for their part in the violence there?
Well, you heard the list of police that responded, right?
Yeah.
There were none.
Were none, yeah.
No.
Made sure that wasn't going to happen, right? Yeah. But by the early 20s, just fast-forwarding here, the KKK was here, and they were targeting Irish politicians, a part of our history. In fact, you brought in a photograph of the Ku Klux Klan doing their thing. What was that all about?
And that's something that's rarely talked about, and I have never seen those those photos. Some of them, when I showed you, I've never seen them published in a major publication here in KC. The Ku Klux Klan. Now, you got, I have to understand the 1920s. And they figured they had the blacks in their place pretty much by then. So the targets of their animosity were, in this order, Catholics, Jews, and Negroes.
Hmm.
And the there was, of course, again, just like the American Protective Association, you know, 20 years before, 25 years before, there was this fear permeating around the country that
the Pope was going to take over America.
The Pope was going to take over America, and he was doing it through his lieges, the priests. But the twin devil, the papists' partner, if you will, were the Irish Catholic politicians, because they were taking over the cities. And at that same time, it's interesting, there was a St. Vincent's Church and School, which is, you know, still there at 31st and Paseo, was under construction. Mm-hmm. That church was being built, and it was all a stone, massive stone. And when it first went up, it looked like you were building a stockade, like a fort. And there was rumors that that was one of the pillboxes, essentially, that he was going to build around the country. These churches were really, you know, like the castles of old, where they would create these bastions around. And so there was this great fear that of this happening.
And that resentment would linger into the 60s when John F. Kennedy ran for president.
And
he had
to
overcome
absolutely.
The whole Catholic idea.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is the same days in the teens and 20s when Irish were very often portrayed as simian, I mean, monkey-faced and big-jawed and heavy-browed. I was telling a fellow this morning, I saw a cartoon from around the turn of the century where it had scales of justice, and there were, or just scales, and there was two swings hanging from a scale, and it was a black man in one and a monkey-faced Irishman in the other, basically saying they're equal, they're nothing. You know, they're both down at the bottom of the pile. But anyway, the Klan came in, and this is something, it's hard to believe. Picture, supposedly 10,000 Klan members came to have a convention here. And I say in those days, the Klan was just as welcome as a hardware convention, you know, as long as they spent money and came in town. And you could buy a robe for $6 and the whole regalia, and you could buy a bottle of water from the Chattahoochee River, some sort of magic water for $1. It was also the days of proliferation of secret societies, woodmen of the world, all those kinds of things. So a lot of people joined kind of half-heartedly. But they had this convention, and they had this parade that went right – they lined up in front of Union Station, and there's pictures of it with like hundreds of Klansmen in full regalia with automobiles welcoming Hiram. And it was Hiram Evans was the grand wizard in that day. He was the ironclad ruler of the Ku Klux Klan. And they – when Hiram arrived from the train station, they put him in a lead car, and they drove, had a big parade right down Grand, right where the St. Patrick's Day parade went for so many years. There were cross burnings. There was one in out south of Independence, and another one reported south of Lee Summit. And these Kleagles, they were recruiters, were here to recruit new members.
That and so many other stories, Pat O'Neill will be telling them at 2 p.m. Sunday at the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch at 14 West 10th Street. Pat, it's always great to have you here. Thanks for taking the time
to come in
today.
Thanks for having me, Steve.